At least they were before Herb got killed. I suppose there are now five. IFAs, independent financial advisors. He wrote it down. Are you one of those? He asked. Yes. And you have clients of your own? Yes, I said. I have about 50 clients, but I spend about half my time looking after Patrick's clients. And how many clients does Mr. Lyle have? About 600, I said. Apart from Herb Kobach and myself, there are two other assistants that help look after them. Are they also IFAs? One is, I said, although she's just recently qualified and has no clients of her own yet. And the other isn't. I gave him their names and he found them on the list of all the firm's staff. How can you be independent if you work for a firm? It was a good question, and one that I was asked often. Independent in this case means we're independent of any investment providers, and we're therefore free to advise our clients about all investment opportunities. If you go to see your bank about investing some money, an advisor there will only sell you something from that bank's investment portfolio, even if there are better products elsewhere. They may be excellent financial advisors, but they are not independent. So how do you make your money? He asked. I'm sure you don't do this for free. No, I agreed. We make our money in one of two ways, depending on the client. Most of them nowadays opt to pay us a fixed fee, which is a small percentage of the total we invest for them, and others choose that we collect the commissions from investment providers on the products we advise them to buy. I see, he said. But I wondered if he did. How much money do you look after in total? Lots, I said flippantly, but he didn't laugh. Some clients have just a few thousand to invest, others have millions. I suppose the firm as a whole looks after hundreds of millions. Most of our clients are high earners, or they have considerable family wealth, or both. And these clients trust you with large sums of their money, he sounded surprised. Yes, I said, and they trust us because we have masses of safeguards and checks to ensure that none of it goes missing. And do these safeguards and checks work? Absolutely, I said, trying to sound affronted that he should even question it. Could Mr. Kobach have been stealing from his clients? Impossible, I replied instantly, but I couldn't help thinking about what Claudia had said the previous afternoon about not knowing if someone was a crook. Everything we do is subject to spot-check inspections by the financial services regulatory authorities, and we have someone called a compliance officer in the firm whose job is to scrutinise the transactions to ensure they're done according to the rules. If Herb had been stealing from his clients, the compliance officer would have seen it, not to mention the regulator. He looked down at the staff list. Which is the compliance officer? Jessica Winter, I said. He found her on the list. She was the woman who asked you earlier if we could go out for a coffee. He nodded. How well did Mr. Kobach know Miss Winter? I laughed. If you're suggesting that Herb Kobach and Jessica Winter conspired together to steal from his clients, you can forget it. Herb thought that our dear compliance officer was an arrogant little prig, and she thought he was a bit of a maverick. Jessica was the only person in the firm who didn't like Herb. Maybe that was just a front, said the detective, writing a note. My, you do have a suspicious mind, I said. Yes, he said, looking up. And it's surprising how often I'm right. Could he really be right? Could Herb and Jessica have been fooling the rest of us all this time? And could anyone else at the firm also be involved? I told myself not to be so silly. At this rate, I would soon be distrustful of my own mother. And do you also think Mr. Kobach was a bit of a maverick? No, I said, not really. He was just a flamboyant American in a business where people have a bit of a reputation for being boring. And are you boring? He said, looking up at me. Probably, I said. I was certainly more boring now than I had been as a jockey. But maybe it was better being boring and alive than flamboyant and dead. I returned to the reception area after my interview to join the other 15 members of the firm squashed into the client waiting area that had been designed for just a small coffee table and two armchairs. What did they ask you? Jessica said. Not much, I said, looking at her and trying not to let her see in my face the questions about her that the chief inspector had triggered in my mind. They just want to know what Herb did here and why I thought anyone would want to kill him. Surely he wasn't killed because of his work, Jessica looked shocked. I thought it must be to do with his private life.
I don't think they have the slightest idea why he was killed, said Patrick Lyle. That's why they're asking about everything.
There was a slight commotion outside in the lobby as someone not on the company staff list tried to gain access. He was being barred by our rather overbearing uniformed guard. I could see through the glass door that the would-be visitor was Andrew Meller, the company solicitor. Lyle and Black was too small to have a full-time company lawyer of its own, so we used Andrew, who worked in a legal practice round the corner in King William Street. Patrick saw him as well and went over to the door.
"It's all right, officer. Mr. Meller is our lawyer." "But he's not on my list," said the uniformed policeman adamantly. "It was I who provided that list, and I forgot to add Mr. Meller."
Reluctantly, the policeman stood aside and allowed the visitor to enter.
"Sorry, Andrew," said Patrick. "It's all a bit of a nightmare here at present."
"Yes, so I can see." Andrew Meller looked around at the sea of faces. "I'm so sorry to hear about Herb Kovac. Unbelievable business." "And bloody inconvenient, too," interjected Gregory, who had been mostly quiet since his altercation with the chief inspector earlier. "Well, I'm glad you're here." I wondered if Gregory had asked Andrew to come round to be present during his interview. "We'll have to talk outside." Gregory began to ease himself up from one of the armchairs. "Actually, Gregory," said the lawyer, putting up a hand to stop him, "it's not you I've come to see. I need to talk to Nicholas." 15 pairs of eyes swiveled round in my direction. "Do you mind?" he said to me, holding out his arm towards the door. I could almost feel the stares on my back as I went outside into the lobby with Andrew. We went past the lifts and round a corner so that the prying eyes in Lyle and Black could no longer see us through the glass door, and the policeman on guard couldn't hear our conversation. "Sorry about this," he said, "but I have something to give you." He pulled a white envelope out of his jacket inside pocket and held it out to me. I took it. "What is it?" I asked. "Herb Kovac's last will and testament." I looked up from the envelope to Andrew's face. "But why are you giving it to me?" I asked. "Because Herb named you in it as his executor." "Me?" I said, somewhat taken aback. "Yes," Andrew said. "And you are also the sole beneficiary of his estate." I was astonished. "Has he no family?" "Obviously none that he wanted to leave anything to." "But why would he want to leave it to me?" I asked. "I've no idea," Andrew said. "Perhaps he liked you." Little did I realize at the time how Herb Kovac's legacy would turn out to be a poisoned chalice. Chapter 3. On Tuesday, I went to the races. Cheltenham races, to be precise. But this was no pleasure outing, it was work. Racing can be a funny business, especially amongst the jockeys. Competition is intense. It always has been. Before the advent in 1960 of the Racing Patrol films, to aid the Stewarts in catching the wrongdoers, stories abounded of jockeys who would cut off a rival, giving them no room, and literally putting a horse and rider through the wings of a fence in order to help their own chances of winning. And riding whips have not always been employed solely to strike the horse, but have left their mark on jockeys too. On one famous occasion at Deauville in France, Lester Piggott, having dropped his own whip, pinched one from another jockey actually during the race to help him ride a tight finish. But once the race is run, whatever the result, there exists a camaraderie between these men and women who risk their lives 5 or 6 times an afternoon for the entertainment of others, and they look after their own. Such it was with me. My erstwhile opponents, who during my riding days would have happily seen me dumped onto the turf if it meant they could win a race, were the first to express their concern and support when I'd been injured. When I had been forced to retire at the ripe old age of 21, it had been a handful of my fellow jocks who had arranged a testimonial day for me at Sandown Park to raise the funds needed to pay my university tuition fees. And it had been the same individuals who had clamoured to become my first clients when I'd qualified as an IFA. Since then, I had acquired a bit of a reputation as horse racing's very own financial advisor. Nearly all my clients had some connection with racing, and I had a near monopoly within the jockey's changing room that I believed had much to do with a shared view of risk and reward. So I now regularly spent a couple of days a week at one racecourse or another, all with Patrick and Gregory's blessing, making appointments to see my clients before or after, and occasionally during the racing. Cheltenham in April has a touch of After the Lord Mayor's Show about it, rather an anticlimax after the heady excitement of the 4-day steeplechase festival in March. Gone were the temporary grandstands and the acres of tented hospitality village. Gone, too, was the nervous energy and high anticipation of 70,000 expectant spectators waiting to cheer home their new heroes. This April meeting may have been a more sedate affair in the enclosures, but it was no less competitive on the course, with two of the top jockeys still vying to be crowned as the champion for the current season that concluded at the end of the month. Both were my clients, and I had arranged to meet one of them, Billy Searle, after racing. Part of the government's anti-money laundering requirements was that financial advisers had to know their clients, and Lion and Black, as a firm, reckoned that a face-to-face meeting with every client should occur at least annually, in addition to our regular three-monthly written communications and twice-yearly valuations of their investments. I had long ago decided that expecting racing folk to come to a meeting in the London offices was a complete waste of time. If I wanted them as clients, and I did, then I would have to come to see them, not vice versa. And I had found that seeing them at their place of work, the racecourses, was easier than chasing after them at home. I had also discovered that being regularly seen at the races was the best way to recruit new clients, which was why I was currently standing on the terrace in front of the weighing room, warming myself in the midday April sunshine more than 90 minutes before the first race.
Ah, Foxy, penny for your thoughts. What a lovely day, eh? Did you see the National yesterday?
Martin Gifford was a large, jovial, middle-ranking racehorse trainer who always joked that he had never made it as a jockey due to his large feet. The fact that he stood more than 6 feet tall and had a waist measurement that a sumo wrestler would have been proud of seemed to have escaped him. No, I said, I missed it. I was stuck in the office all day. I just saw the short report on the television news. But I'd been at Aintree on Saturday.
Well, bloody rum business that was, Martin said. Fancy postponing the Grand National just because some bastard got themselves killed.
He had obviously been reading the papers. How do you know he was a bastard? I asked. Martin looked at me strangely.
Because it said so in the paper.
I thought you knew better than to believe what you read in the papers. I paused, deciding whether to go on. The person murdered was a friend of mine. I was standing right next to him when he was shot.
Bloody hell! Shouted Murray. God, I'm sorry. Trust me to jump in with both feet.
Trust him indeed. That's okay, I said. Forget it. I was suddenly cross with myself for even mentioning it to him. Why hadn't I just kept quiet? Everyone in racing knew that Martin Gifford was a five-star gossip. In an industry where there were many who believed that there was no such thing as a private conversation or a secret, Martin was the past master. He seemed to have a talent for knowing other people's private business and passing it on to anyone who would listen. Telling Martin that the murder victim had been a friend of mine was akin to placing a full-page spread in the Racing Post to advertise the fact, except quicker. Everyone at Cheltenham would probably know by the end of the afternoon, and I was already regretting my indiscretion. So, was the National a good race? I asked, trying to change the subject.
Well, I suppose so, he said. Diplomatic Leak won easily in the end, but he made a right hash of the canal turn first time round. Nearly ended up in the canal.
Were there many people there? I asked.
Looked pretty full to me, he said. But I watched it on television.
No runners? I asked. But I knew he hadn't any.
I haven't had a National horse for years, he said. Not since Frosty Branch in the '90s, and it was the death of him, poor fellow.
Any runners today? I asked.
Fallen Leaf in the first and Yellow Digger in the 3 mile chase.
Well, good luck, I said.
Yeah, we'll need it, he said. Fallen Leaf probably wouldn't win if he started now. And I don't rate Yellow Digger very highly at all. He has no chance.
He paused.
So, who was this friend of yours who got killed? Damn it, I thought. I'd hoped he would leave it, but I should have known better.
Martin Gifford hadn't earned his reputation for nothing.
He was just a work colleague, really, I said, trying to sound indifferent. What was his name?
I wondered if I should tell him, but why not? It had been in all of yesterday's papers.
Herbert Kovac. And why was he killed? Martin demanded. Well, I've no idea, I said. As I told you, he was only a work colleague. Come on, Foxy, Martin said in an inviting tone. You must have some inkling.
No, none, nothing. He looked disappointed, like a child told he can't have any sweets.
Go on, he implored once more. I know you're holding something back. You can tell me.
And half the world, I thought. Honestly, Martin, I said, I have absolutely no idea why he was killed or who did it. And if I did, I'd be telling the police, not you.
Martin shrugged his shoulders, as if to imply he didn't fully believe me. Too bad, I thought, it was true. I was saved from further inquisition by another trainer, Jan Setter, who was everything that Martin Gifford wasn't, short, slim, attractive, and fun. She grabbed my arm and turned me round, away from Martin. "Hello, lover boy," she whispered in my ear while giving me a kiss on the cheek. "Fancy a dirty weekend away?" "I'm ready when you are," I whispered back. "Just name your hotel." She pulled back and laughed. "Oh, you're such a tease," she said, looking up at me beguilingly from beneath her heavily mascaraed eyelids. But it was she who was the tease, and she'd been doing it since we'd first met more than 10 years ago. Back then, I had been an impressionable 18-year-old just starting out, and she was an established trainer for whom I was riding. I hadn't really known how to react, whether to be flattered or frightened. Apart from anything else, at the time, she'd been a married woman. Nowadays, she was a mid-to-late-40s divorcee who seemed intent on enjoying life, not that she didn't work hard. Her stables in Lambourne were full with about 70 horses in training, and as I knew from experience, she ran the place with great efficiency and determination. Jan had been one of my clients now for 3 years, ever since she had acquired a substantial sum from her ex during a very public High Court divorce case. I adored her, and not just for her patronage. Perhaps I should accept her invitation to a dirty weekend away, but that would then have changed everything. "How's my money?" she asked. "Alive and kicking," I replied. "And growing, I hope," she laughed. So did I. "How was the preview?" "Fabulous," she said. "I took my daughter Maria and a friend of hers. We had a really wonderful time. The show was terrific." At my suggestion, Jan had invested a considerable sum in a new West End musical based on the life of Florence Nightingale set during the Crimean War. The true opening night was a week or so away, but the previews had just started, and I'd read some of the newspaper reports and pre-reviews. They had been somewhat mixed, but that didn't always mean the show wouldn't be a success. The Wizard of Oz spin-off musical, Wicked, had been panned by the New York Times after its opening night on Broadway, but it was still running there more than 7 years and 3,000 performances later, and it was breaking box office records all around the world. "Some of the pre-reviews are not great," I said. "I can't think why," Jan replied with surprise. "That girl that plays Florence is gorgeous, and what a voice! I think she'll make me a fortune. I am sure the proper reviews after the first night will be fabulous," she laughed. "But I'll blame my financial advisor if they aren't, and I lose it all." "I hear he has broad shoulders," I said, laughing back. But it wasn't necessarily a laughing matter. Investing in the theatre had always been a high-risk strategy, and fortunes had been lost far more often than they'd been won. Not that investing in anything was certain. It was always a gamble. I had known some seemingly cast-iron and gold-plated investments go belly up almost without warning. Shares in big established companies were usually safe with expected steady growth, but even that was not always the case. Enron shares had fallen from a healthy $90 each to just a few cents within 10 weeks, while HealthSouth, Inc., one of America's largest healthcare providers, had lost 98% of its value on the New York Stock Exchange in a single day. Both those collapses had been due to fraud or dodgy accounting practices inflating their revenues and profits, but business catastrophes can have the same effect. BP's shares fell in value by more than 50% in a month when an oil platform exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, even though the costs associated with the explosion and the subsequent oil clear-up represented far less than half the company's assets. Could such a calamitous loss have resulted in Herb's murder? I couldn't believe it was possible. Patrick Lyle held regular meetings, usually on a Monday, when investment plans for our clients were discussed. All his assistants were present, and that had included Herb and myself. We were expected to research the markets and put forward investment suggestions, for example, the new musical that I had recommended to Jan Setter. But the firm's rule was clear and simple. None of our clients' money could be invested in any product without the prior approval of either Patrick or Gregory. Our exposure to BP losses had been mostly through personal pension schemes, and bad as it was, the risks had been well spread, with no individuals actually losing their shirts, or even as much as a tie. Certainly not enough, I thought, to murder their advisor. "You should come and ride out for me,"
said Jan, bringing my daydreaming back to the present. First lot goes out at 7:30 on Saturdays. Come down on a Friday and stay the night. You'd enjoy it. Now, was that an invitation to a dirty weekend or not? And yes, I would enjoy it. The riding, that is. At least I think I would have. But I hadn't sat on a horse in 8 years. I could remember so clearly the devastation I had felt when told I couldn't be a jockey anymore. I had been sitting at an oak table in the offices of the Jockey Club in High Holborn, London. Opposite me were the three members of the medical board. I could recall almost word for word the brief announcement made by the board chairman. "Sorry, Foxton," he had said, almost before we were all comfortable in our chairs.
"We have concluded that you are, and will permanently remain, unfit to ride in any form of racing. Consequently, your jockey's license has been withdrawn indefinitely."
It then started to rise to leave the room. I sat there completely stunned. My skin had gone suddenly cold, and the walls had seemed to press inwards towards me. I had expected the meeting with the board to be a formality, just another necessary inconvenience on the long road to recovery. "Hold on a minute," I'd said, turning in my chair towards the departing chairman. "I was told to come here to answer some questions." "What questions?" The chairman had stopped in the doorway.
"We don't need to ask you any questions. Your scan results have given us all the answers we need."
"Well, I have some questions to ask you, so please sit down." I could recall the look of surprise on his face that a jockey, or an ex-jockey, would talk to him in such a manner, but he did come back and sit down again opposite me. I asked my questions, and I argued myself hoarse, but to no avail.
"Our decision is final."
But of course I hadn't been prepared to leave it at that. I'd arranged to have a second opinion from a top specialist in neck and spinal injuries to help me win my case, but he only served to confirm the medical board's findings, as well as frightening me half to death.
"The problem," he told me, "is that the impact of your fall occurred with such force that your atlas vertebra was effectively crushed into the axis beneath. You are very lucky to be alive, extraordinarily lucky, in fact. Quite apart from the main fracture right through the axis, many of the interlocking bone protrusions that helped hold the two vertebrae together have been broken away. Put in simple terms, your head is balanced precariously on your neck, and the slightest trauma might be enough to cause it to topple. With that neck, I wouldn't ride a bike, let alone a horse."
It hadn't exactly been encouraging.
"Is there nothing that can be done?" I'd asked him. "An operation or something? How about a metal plate? I still have one in my ankle from a previous break."
"This part of the neck is a difficult area," he'd said. "Far more complicated than even an ankle. There are so many planes and degrees of movement involved. Then there is the attachment of the skull, not to mention the inconvenience of having the nerves for the rest of your body passing right through the middle of it all. Indeed, the brainstem itself stretches down to the axis vertebra. I don't think a metal plate would help, and it would certainly be another problem you could do without. In normal life, your muscles will hold everything together and your neck should be fine. Just try not to have a car crash." He'd smiled at me.
"And whatever you do, don't get into a fight." For weeks afterwards, I had hardly turned my head at all, and for a while I'd gone back to wearing a neck brace to sleep in. I remember being absolutely terrified to sneeze in case my head fell off, and I hadn't even been near a horse, let alone on one's back. So much for being a carefree risk-taker. The health and safety executive had nothing on me when it came to my neck.
"I'd love to come and watch your horses work," I said to Jan, returning once again to the present. "But I'm afraid I can't ride one." She looked disappointed.
"I thought you'd love it."
"I would have," I said, "but it's too much of a risk with my neck."
"What a bloody shame," she said.
Bloody shame was right. I longed to ride again. Coming racing every week was a pleasant change from spending all my time in a London office, but in some ways it was a torment. Each day I chatted amicably to my clients as they wore their racing silks, and I positively ached to be one of them again. Even after all this time, I would sometimes sit in my car at the end of a day and weep for what I had lost. Why had this happened to me? I shook my head, albeit only slightly, and told myself to put such thoughts of self-pity out of my mind. I had much to be thankful for, and I should be happy to be 29 years old, alive, employed, and financially secure.
But oh, how I wanted still to be a jockey.
I watched the first race from a vantage point on the grandstand, the vivid harlequin-coloured jackets of the jockeys appearing bright in the sunshine as they cantered down to the 2-mile hurdle start. As always, the undiminished longing to be out there with them weighed heavy in the pit of my stomach. I wondered if it would ever go away. Even though Cheltenham had been the scene of my last ill-fated ride, I held no grudge towards the place. It hadn't been the racecourse's fault that I'd been so badly injured. In fact, it was only due to their paramedics' great care after the fall that I wasn't paralysed or dead. Cheltenham had been the first racecourse I had ever known, and I still loved the place. I had grown up in Prestbury Village, right alongside the course, and I'd ridden my bicycle past it every morning on my way to school. Each March, as the Steeplechase Festival approached, the excitement surrounding not only the racecourse but the whole town had been the inspiration for me, first to ride a horse, then to pester a local trainer for holiday jobs, and finally to give up a planned future of anodyne academia for the perilous existence of a professional jockey. Cheltenham was the home of jump racing. Whereas the Grand National was the most famous steeplechase in the world, every racehorse owner would rather win the Cheltenham Gold Cup. The Grand National was a handicap, so the better horses carried the greater weight. The handicapper's dream was that all the horses would cross the finish line in a huge dead heat. But it was a bit like making Usain Bolt run the Olympic 100 metres in Wellington boots to even up the chances of the others. However, in the Cheltenham Gold Cup, other than a slight reduction for female horses, all the participants carried the same weight, and the winner was the true champion. I had only ridden in it once, on a rank outsider that had had no chance, but I could still recall the tension that had existed in the jockey's changing room beforehand. The Gold Cup was not just another race, it was history in the making, and one's performance mattered even if, as in my case, I had pulled up my horse long before the finish. Away to my left, at the far end of the straight, the 15 horses for the first race were called into line by the starter.
"They're off,"
sounded the public address, and they were running. 2 miles of fast-paced hurdle racing with the clatter-clatter from hooves striking the wooden obstacles, clearly audible to those of us in the grandstands. The horses first swept up the straight towards us, then turned left-handed to start another complete circuit of the course, ever increasing in speed. 3 horses jumped the final hurdle side by side, and a flurry of jockeys' legs, arms and whips encouraged their mounts up the hill to the finish.
"First, number 3, Fallen Leaf," sounded the public address system.
Mark Vickers, the other jockey in the race to be the champion, had just extended his lead over Billy Searle from 1 to 2. And Martin Gifford, the gossip, had trained the winner in spite of his expressed lack of faith in its ability. I wondered if he had simply been trying to keep his horse's starting price high by recommending that other people should not bet on it. I looked down at my race card and decided to invest a small sum on Yellow Digger in the 3rd race, the other runner Martin had told me would have no chance. I turned to go back to the weighing room, looking down at my feet to negotiate the grandstand steps.
"Hello, Nicholas."
I looked up.
"Hello, Mr. Roberts," I said in surprise. "I didn't realise you were a racing man."
"Oh, yes," he said. "Always have been. In fact, my brother and I have horses in training, and I often used to watch you ride. You were a good jockey. You should have been one of the greats."
He pursed his lips and shook his head. "Oh, thank you," I said. "Mr. Roberts, or to use his full title, Colonel the Honourable Jolyon Westrop Roberts, MCOBE, younger son of the Earl of Balscott, was a client. To be precise, he was a client of Gregory Black, but I had met him fairly frequently in the offices at Lombard Street. Whereas many clients are happy to leave us to get on with looking after their money, Jolyon Roberts was one of those known to have a hands-on approach to his investments.
"Are you on your day off?" he asked.
"No," I replied with a laugh. "I'm seeing one of my clients after racing, you know, the jockey Billy Searle." He nodded, then paused.
"I don't suppose..." He paused again.
"No, it doesn't matter."
"Can I help you in some way?" I asked.
"No, it's all right. I'll leave it."
"Leave what?" I asked.
"Oh, nothing," he said. "Nothing for you to worry about. It's fine, I'm sure it's fine."
What is fine?" I asked with persistence. "Is it something to do with the firm?"
"No, it's nothing," he said. "Forget I even mentioned it."
"But you didn't mention anything."
"Oh, right,"
he said with a laugh. "So I didn't." "Are you sure there is nothing I can help you with?" I asked again.
Yes, I'm sure, he said. Thank you.
I stood there on the grandstand steps for a few seconds looking at him, but he made no further obscure reference to whatever was clearly troubling him. Right then, I said. No doubt I'll see you sometime in the office. Bye now.
Yes, he replied. Right. Goodbye.
I walked away, leaving him there, standing ramrod straight and looking out across the course as if in deep thought. I wondered what that had all been about. Mark Vickers won twice more during the afternoon, including the big race on Yellow Digger at the relatively long odds of 8-1, giving Mark a 4-winner lead over Billy Searle in the championship race, and me a tidy payout from the tote. Billy Searle was not in the least bit happy when he emerged from the weighing room after the last race for our meeting.
Bloody Vickers, he said to me. Did you see the way he won the first? Beat the poor animal half to death with his whip. Steward should have banned him for excessive use.
I decided not to say that I actually thought that Mark Vickers had been rather gentle with his use of the whip in the first race, and had in fact written a textbook finish with his hands and heels to win by a head. Perhaps, in the circumstances, it wouldn't have been very diplomatic. I also chose not to mention to Billy that Mark was a client of mine as well.
But there's still plenty of time left for you to catch him, I said,
though I knew there wasn't. And Mark Vickers was bang in form while Billy was not.
It's my bloody turn, he said vehemently. I've been waiting all these years to get my chance, and now, with Frank injured, I'm going to bloody lose out to some young upstart.
Life could be hard. Billy Searle was 4 years older than me, and he'd been runner-up in the championship for each of the past 8 years. Every time he'd been beaten by the same man, the jump jockey recognised by all as the best in the business, Frank Miller. But Frank had broken his leg badly in a fall the previous December, and had been out of action now for 4 months. This year, for the first time in a decade, it would be someone else's turn to be champion jockey, but after today's triple for Mark Vickers, it seemed likely that it wouldn't be Billy. And time was no longer on Billy's side. 33 is getting on for a jump jockey, and the new crop of youngsters were good, very good. And they were also hungry for success. It was obvious to me that Billy was in no real mood to discuss his finances, even though it had been he, not me, who had called the previous afternoon asking for this urgent meeting at Cheltenham. But I'd come all the way from London to talk to him, and I didn't want it to be a wasted journey. What was it that you wished to discuss? I asked him.
I want all my money back, he said suddenly.
What do you mean back? I asked.
I want all my money back from Lyle and Black.
But your money is not with Lyle and Black, I said. It's in the investments that we bought for you. You still own them.
Well, I want it back anyway.
Why? I asked.
I just do, he said crossly. And I don't need to tell you why. It's my money and I want it back.
He was building himself into a full-blown fury.
Surely I can do what I like with my own money.
Okay, Billy, I said, trying to calm him down. Of course you can have the money back, but it's not that simple. I will need to sell the shares and bonds you have. I can do that tomorrow.
Fine,
he said. But Billy, I said, some of your investments were bought with long-term growth in mind. Just last week I acquired some 30-year government bonds for you. If I have to sell them tomorrow, you are likely to sustain a loss.
I don't care, he said. I need the money now.
All right, I said, but as your financial advisor, I have to ask you again why you need your money so quickly. If I had more time to sell, you might get a better return.
I haven't got more time, he said.
Why not?
I can't tell you.
Billy, I said seriously, are you in some sort of trouble?
No, of course not,
he said, but his body language gave another answer. I could remember most of the details of the investment portfolios of most of my clients, and Billy Searle was no exception. His was rather smaller than one might imagine after so many years at the top of his profession. But Billy had always been a spender rather than a saver, driving expensive cars and staying in lavish hotels. However, as far as I could recall, he had a nest egg of around $150,000 growing nicely for his retirement, certainly more than he would prudently need for a new car or a foreign holiday. Okay, Billy, I said, I'll get on with liquidating everything tomorrow, but it'll take a few days for you to get the cash.
Can't I have it tomorrow?
He looked desperate.
I need it tomorrow.
Billy, that simply isn't possible. I need to sell the shares and bonds, have the funds transferred into the company's client account, and then transfer it to your own. Banks always say to allow 3 days for each transfer, so overall it might take a week, but it will probably be a little quicker than that. Today's Tuesday. You might have it by Friday if you're lucky, but more likely it will be Monday. Billy went pale. Billy, I said,
Are you sure you're not in any trouble?
I owe a guy some money, that's all, he said. He says I have to pay him by tomorrow.
You will just have to tell him that's impossible, I said. Explain to him the reasons. I'm sure he'll understand. Billy gave me a look that said everything. Clearly the guy in question wouldn't take excuses. I'm sorry, I said, but I can't do it any quicker.
Can't your firm lend me the money until everything's sold? He asked.
Billy, I said, it's £150,000. We don't have that sort of cash lying around.
I only need 100.
He said, no, I said firmly. Not even 100.
You don't understand, he said in desperation. I need that money by tomorrow night.
He was almost crying. Why, I asked him, why do you owe so much?
I can't tell you.
He almost screamed the words at me. And the heads of a few other late-leaving racegoers turned our way.
But I need it tomorrow.
I looked at him. And I cannot help you, I said quietly. I think I'd better go now. Do you still want me to sell your portfolio and liquidate the money?
Yes,
he said in a resigned tone. Right, I said. I'll get the office to send you a written authority. Just sign it and send it straight back. I'll try and get the cash into your account by Friday. He was almost in a trance.
I hope I'm still alive by Friday.
Chapter 4. I sat in my car in the members' car park and thought through my recent conversation with Billy Searle. I wondered what I should do about it, if anything. As he had said, it was his money, and he could do what he liked with it, except that he clearly didn't like what he was doing with it. He'd also told me that he owed some guy about £100,000 and had implied that his life would be in danger if he didn't repay it by the following evening. I would have usually dismissed such a threat as melodramatic nonsense, but now, after the events at Aintree the previous Saturday, I wasn't so sure. Should I tell someone about our conversation? But who? The police would probably want some evidence, and I had none. I also didn't want to get Billy into trouble. Jockeys who owe money would always be suspected of involvement with bookmakers. Perhaps Billy's need for urgent cash was completely legitimate. Maybe he was buying a house. I knew that estate agents could be pretty determined in their selling methods, but surely they didn't threaten murder to close a deal. I decided to do nothing until I'd had a chance to discuss it with Patrick. Besides, I would need to inform him before I could start the process of liquidating Billy's assets. I looked at my watch. It was already past 6 o'clock and the office would be closed. I'd have to speak to Patrick about it in the morning. Nothing could be done now, anyway. The markets in London were also long closed for the day. Instead, I went to stay with my mother. "Hello, darling," she said, opening her front door. "You're far too thin." It was her usual greeting, and one that was due to her long-standing pathological fear that I was anorexic. It had all started when I'd been a skinny 15-year-old who'd been desperate to be a jockey. I'd never been very short, so I had begun starving myself to keep my weight down. But it hadn't been due to anorexia, just willpower. I had always loved my food, but it seemed that my body and my mind had now finally trained themselves to stay thin. As a rule, I never really thought about food. And if left to my own devices, there was little doubt that I would have become undernourished through neglect. But my mother saw to it that I didn't. She would send food parcels to Claudia with strict instructions to feed me more protein or more carbohydrate or just more. "Hello, Mum," I said, ignoring her comment and giving her a kiss. "How are things?" "So-so," she replied, as always. She still lived near Cheltenham, but not in the big house in which I had grown up. Sadly, that had had to be sold during my parents' acrimonious divorce proceedings in order to divide the capital between them. My mother's current home was a modest whitewashed cottage, hidden down a rutted lane on the edge of a small village just north of the racecourse, with two double bedrooms and a bathroom upstairs, and a single open-plan kitchen-diner-lounge downstairs, the levels connected by a narrow, twisting, boxed-in staircase in the corner, with a lever-latch door at the bottom. The cottage was an ideal size for her enforced solitary lifestyle, but I knew she longed still to be the charming hostess in the grand house, a role in which she had excelled throughout my childhood. "How's your father?" she asked. Her inquiry was a social nicety rather than a true request for information. She probably thought that I'd appreciate her asking.
"He's fine,"
I replied, completing the duty.
At least, I assumed he was fine. I hadn't spoken to him for more than a fortnight. We really didn't have much to say to each other.
Good,
she said, but I doubt that she really meant it. I thought she would almost certainly have also replied good if I'd told her he was on his deathbed. But at least she had asked, which was more than he ever did about her.
I've bought you some fillet steak for dinner, she said, turning the conversation back to my feeding habits, and I've made some profiteroles for pudding.
Lovely, I said, and I meant it. As usual, when coming to stay with my mother, I hadn't eaten anything all day in preparation for a high-calorie encounter with her cooking, and by now I was really hungry. I went up to the guest bedroom and changed out of my suit and into jeans and a sweatshirt. I tossed my mobile onto the bed. As always, the closeness to Cleve Hill and the phone signal shadow it produced rendered the thing useless, but at least I'd have a rest from its constant ringing. When I came down, my mother was standing by the stove with saucepans already steaming on the hob. "Help yourself to a glass of wine," she said over her shoulder. "I've already got one." I went over to the antique sideboard that had once sat in the dining room of the big house and helped myself to a glass of Merlot from the open bottle.
"How is Claudia?" my mother asked.
"Fine, thank you," I said. "She sends her love."
"She should have come with you."
Yes, I thought she should have. There had been a time when we couldn't bear to be apart even for a single night, but now that longing had seemingly evaporated. Perhaps that is what happens after 6 years.
"High time you made an honest woman out of her," my mother said. "Time you were married and raising children."
Was it? In spite of what had happened to my parents, I'd always believed that someday I would marry and have a family. A few years ago, I'd even discussed the prospect with Claudia, but she had dismissed the notion, saying that marriage was for boring people, and that children were troublesome, and not for artists like her who were busy pushing the boundaries of existence and imagination. I wondered if she still felt the same way. There had certainly been no recent hints about rings on the finger or brooding over other people's babies, but if there were, would I still have welcomed them?
"But you and Dad are hardly a great advertisement for marriage," I said, possibly unwisely.
"Nonsense," she said, turning round to face me. "We were married for 30 years and brought you into the world. I would call that a success."
"But you got divorced," I said in disbelief, "and you fought all the time."
"Well, maybe we did," she said, turning back to the pans, "but it was still a success, and I don't regret it." I was amazed. She must be getting soft in her old age.
"No," she went on, "I don't regret it for a second, because otherwise you wouldn't exist."
What could I say? Nothing. So I didn't.
She turned back to face me once more. "And now I want some grandchildren."
Ah, I thought, there had to be a reason somewhere. And I was an only child.
"You should have had more children yourself then," I said with a laugh. "Not good to put all your eggs in one basket."
She stood very still, and I thought she was going to cry. I placed my glass down on the kitchen table, stepped forward and put my arm around her shoulder. "I'm sorry," I said, "I shouldn't have said that." "It's all right," she said, reaching for a tissue and dabbing her eyes. "You never knew."
"Knew what?" I asked.
"Nothing. Forget it." It clearly wasn't nothing if it reduced her to tears all these years later. "Come on, Mum," I said. "Something's obviously troubling you. Tell me." She sighed.
"We wanted more children. We wanted lots. You were the first, although you were quite a long time coming, as we'd been married for nearly 8 years by then. I was so happy you were a boy."
She smiled at me and stroked my cheek.
"But something had gone wrong with my insides, and we couldn't have any more."
It was I who was almost crying now. I had always so wanted brothers and sisters.
"We tried, of course," she said, "and once I did become pregnant, but the baby miscarried at 3 months. It nearly killed me."
Again, I didn't know what to say, so once more I said nothing. I just hugged her instead.
"It was the real reason behind so much unhappiness in our marriage," she said. "Your father gradually became so bitter that I couldn't have any more babies, stupid man. I suppose it was my body's fault, but I couldn't do anything about it, could I? I tried so hard to make up for it, but she..."
She tailed off.
"Oh, Mum," I said, hugging her tight again, "how awful." "It's all right," she said, pulling away from me and turning back towards the stove.
It's a long time ago. And I'll overcook these potatoes if I don't get to them now.
We sat at the kitchen table for dinner, and I ate myself to a complete standstill. I felt bloated, and still my mother was trying to force me to eat more. "Another profiterole?" she asked, dangling a heaped spoonful over my plate. "Mom," I said, "I'm stuffed. I couldn't eat another thing." She looked disappointed, but in fact, I had eaten far more than I would have normally, even in this house. I had tried to please her, but enough was enough. Another mouthful, and my stomach might have burst. She, meanwhile, had eaten almost nothing. Whereas I had ploughed my way through half a cow along with a mountain of potatoes and vegetables, my mother had picked like a bird at a small circle of steak, much of which she'd fed to an overweight grey cat that purred against her leg for most of the meal.
"I didn't know you'd acquired a cat," I said.
"I didn't," she said. "It acquired me. One day it just arrived, and he has hardly left since." I wasn't surprised if she regularly fed it fillet steak. "He sometimes goes off for a few days, even a week, but he usually comes back eventually." "What's his name?" I asked.
"I've no idea," she said. "He isn't wearing a collar. He's a visitor, not a resident."
"Like me," I thought, "just here for a good meal."
"Are you going to the races tomorrow?" she asked.
The April meeting at Cheltenham ran for 2 days.
"Yes, I'll go for the first few," I said, "but I have some work to do here in the morning. I have my computer with me. Can I use your phone and your broadband connection?"
"Of course you can," she said. "But what time do you plan to leave? I don't want to rush you away, but I have the Village Historical Society outing tomorrow afternoon."
"The first race is at 2 o'clock, I said. "I'll be off around 12.
"Then I'll get you some lunch before you go."
The thought of yet more food was almost unbearable, and I knew she would have bought the makings of a full English breakfast as well.
"No, thanks, Mum," I said. "I'm meeting a client there for lunch."
She looked sideways at me as if to say she knew I'd just lied to her. She was right.
"I don't like it, but we have to do as he asks," said Patrick,
when I called him at 8 in the morning using my mother's phone in the kitchen.
"I'll get Diana on it right away."
Diana was another of his assistants, the one who had just qualified as an IFA.
"Are you at Cheltenham again today?"
"Yes," I said, "but I'll probably just stay for the first three."
"Try and have another word with Billy Searle. Get him to see sense."
"I'll try," I said, "but he seemed pretty determined. Scared, even."
"All sounds a bit fishy to me," Patrick said. "But we are required by the regulator to do as our clients instruct, and we can't go off to the authorities every time they instruct us to do something we don't think is sensible."
"But we have a duty to report anything we believe to be illegal."
"And do you have any evidence that he wants to do something illegal with the funds?"
"No," I paused. "But I wonder if breaking the rules of racing is illegal."
"Depends on what he's doing," said Patrick. "Defrauding the betting public is illegal. Remember that case at the Old Bailey a few years back?"
"I did indeed."
"Billy told me he owed a guy some money," I said. "Seems he needs 100 grand. That's a very big debt. I wonder if he's got mixed up with a bookmaker."
"Betting is not illegal,"
Patrick said.
"Maybe not," I agreed. "But it is strictly against the rules for a professional jockey to bet on horse racing."
"That's not our problem," he said. "And if you do ask Billy any questions, for God's sake, try and be discreet. We also have a duty to keep his affairs confidential."
"Okay, I will. I'll see you in the office tomorrow."
"Right," said Patrick. "Oh, yes, another thing. That policeman called yesterday asking for you."
"He didn't call my mobile. It was on all day, although the damn thing doesn't work here. My mother lives in a mobile phone signal hole."
"No, well, that wouldn't have mattered anyway, because it seems he was rather rude to Mrs. McDowd, so she refused to give him your number. She told him you were unavailable and not to be contacted."
I laughed. Good old Mrs. McDowd, one of our fearless office receptionists.
"What did he want?" I asked.
"Seems they want you to attend at Herb's flat. Something about being his executor."
He gave me the policeman's number, and I stored it in my phone.
"Call him, will you? I don't want Mrs. McDowd arrested for obstructing the police."
"Okay," I said. "See you tomorrow."
I disconnected from Patrick and called Detective Chief Inspector Tomlinson.
"Ah, Mr. Foxton," he said. "Good of you to call. How you feeling?"
"I'm fine," I replied, wondering why he should ask.
"Is your toe okay?" he asked.
"Sorry?"
"Your toe," he repeated. "Your receptionist told me about your operation."
"Oh, that," I said, trying to suppress a laugh. "My toe is fine, thank you. How can I help?"
"Was Mr. Kovac in personal financial difficulties?" he asked.
"In what way?" I said.
"Was he in debt?" Not that I'm aware of, I said. No more than any of us. Why do you ask?
Mr. Foxton, are you well enough to come to Mr. Kovac's home? There are quite a few things I would like to discuss with you, and I also need you, as his executor, to agree to the removal of certain items from his flat to assist with our inquiries. I can send a car if that helps. I thought about my planned day at Cheltenham Races. Tomorrow would be better.
Of course, he said.
How about 8 a.m? 8 tomorrow is fine, I said. I'll be there. Do you need me to send a car?
Why not, I thought.
Yes, that would be great.
I'd have to develop a limp.
Billy Searle was in no mood to explain to me why he suddenly needed his money.
Just put the bloody cash in my